You've got to form a value of the animal as you see, and if you're a good auctioneer, you'll soon know that. As he comes to you, you've got to know pretty nearly what he'll bring and who'll buy him.
It's a sixth sense, isn't it?
It's a sixth sense, that's what it is.
Well, aside from that, you have to have a gift of gab, don't you?
Well, it's necessary to talk fast to sell as fast as I do.
I understand you sell about 75 horses an hour, you can.
That's what I used to average. Well, I've often sold over 100 in an hour.
Well, Mr. Evans, you are, in my opinion, well gifted along those lines of the gift of gab and, of course, understanding your business. But have you ever thought of being a radio announcer?
Well, I might have thought of it, but since I see it tonight, I don't think I will.
You've got me there, I bow out. No, but before I do bow out, I do want to ask you this. Have you ever sold any horses for foreign countries, huge lots of them?
At the end of the war, I sold all of the horses that were in this country belonging to the British, the French, and the Italian government.
What's that song, Horses, Horses, Horses?
To what degree do you think the horse is being replaced by the auto?
Well, I have said several times that years ago a horse used to be afraid of an automobile, but after a while it'll be so if a horse meets another horse, you'll shy away from him. They'll be so scared.
Thank you, Mr. Evans.
You don't know what he is.
Thank you very much. I think you've given us a very clear picture. Now I want to ask Mr. Fitzgerald, William Fitzgerald, who handles the fur auctions. In the fur auctions...
How does an Irishman come to sell furs? That's what I want
to know. How does an Irishman come to sell furs?
I wouldn't dare make it public.
In the fur auctions, where do the furs come from? Where do you get them?
Well, we get them from all parts of the world.
And they're on consignment?
They're sent to us on a consignment basis.
And then how are the furs handled? Are they tagged or put in lots?
They're graded and put into various lots and given a lot number. And thus cataloged.
When the auction gets underway, you're down here in your fur auction, how is the bidding carried on? How do they make the bids?
Well, it's very secretive. One buyer doesn't wish another buyer to know when he's bidding, so he either blinks his eye or wiggles his ear or lifts his finger.
And you have to know all those individual signals for each buyer.
Oh, yes.
I think that's pretty general in our discussions this evening about those secretive bids among the auctioneers that are here, at least from what we said. How often are your fur auctions held?
Well, we hold 4 general sales a year and 5 special silver fox and mink sales during the year.
And that applies to the whole trade?
That applies to the whole trade.
And supplies my lady with everything that she wears in the fur line?
My lady controls the fur line.
She does?
Absolutely.
Well, what is she choosing this year as being very popular?
Well, she still thinks silver fox is very good.
How about red
fox? She's also kind of taking a liking to red fox and mink and beaver. And she's also very fond of muskrats, as she always has been.
I see. How many lots are sold on the average in an hour in your fur auction?
Well, our auctions depend a lot on speed, so we try to sell from 180 to 200 lots an hour.
About yourself now a minute. On what basis is the fur auctioneer paid? Do you have a salary or do you...
Oh, we work on... The fur auctioneer works on a salary.
On a salary. Roughly, what is that salary, roughly?
Well, the fur auctioneer earns from $5,000 to $10,000 a year.
Oh, that's a very good salary. Have you ever sold any furs
to... I think the real estate business have to take hold of that fur business and show them how to make money.
Why, do you make more in real estate?
I
get around to you in a minute. Have you ever sold any furs to celebrities?
Well, several years ago, our firm sold silver foxes that were made into capes for the now Duchess of Windsor.
Really? That's very interesting. That goes back into our public history, I guess.
Well, not too far back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fitzgerald, and for your story of the fur auction and the fur auctioneer. I want to jump over now to the egg auction. I'm jumping over there enough. I've broken about a dozen crates of the egg. Mr. Robert M. Zadra, the auctioneer for the New York Egg Auction Company. Will you tell us, Mr. Zadra, when are the egg auctions held?
Well, we hold our egg auction daily, Monday to Friday inclusive, and we...
In the morning?
At 12:15 every day.
I see. And how long does it run each session?
Well, depending on the volume offered, the average is about an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, just about how many eggs are sold there every day?
Well, on an average of about 1,800 to 2,000 cases daily.
At 30 dozens?
That's 30 dozens to the case, 360 eggs to the case. All fresh eggs, Mr. Dave.
It's about 700,000 eggs.
That's right.
That'd make quite an omelet, Mr. Zadra.
Sure would.
Now, how do you get your bids in the egg auction?
Well, the bids, a lot of them are trick signals. A lot of the customer don't care to let the other one know when they do the bidding. Very often, we apply a number to the customer. And instead of mentioning the customer's name at the time of the purchase, why, we mention his number.
And only you know the number.
And only the firm or the clerk that takes the number down knows who the customer is that does the buying due to the fact that his bidding is secretive.
Well, we've heard all about these trick signals of touching the necktie or winking the eye. Is there anything special down there that you have in
your... Well, we have one particular customer that goes into the candling booth, which is covered by curtains, and every time he cares to make a bid, he just sticks his head out of a candling booth, and that's the sign that he's bidding.
Well, that's quite a picture. I want to ask you, too, you mentioned something about telephone bids when we were speaking before the program. What's that all about? What are telephone
bids? Well, we have out-of-town customers. Well, they cannot attend the auction, so naturally, we have several salesmen on a stand which telephones, and these customers will call in, ask the salesman the way the bidding is going in a certain lot or brand which they might be interested, and they authorize the salesman to represent them in the bidding, and very often they buy large quantities of eggs in that manner.
They keep in constant touch with the auction, then, I take it?
Yes, they do. They receive a catalog of our offerings every morning in their mail.
Well, how is the egg market at present time? How's that going?
Well, at the very present time, the market is very dull.
It is?
Yes.
I don't quite understand that. I can't see how people would stop eating eggs one day and eat them again the next
day. Well, the price factor is predominant as far as the public. I mean, when eggs go up to 51, 53 cents a dozen for the best eggs, why, people will stop eating eggs and probably go to pork and beans or something like that.
And then the price comes back down again.
That's right.
They're not buying.
That's right.
I suppose that the buyers there at your egg auction represent the tastes of your community around, don't they, and their localities?
Yes.
And you get an idea of what the people like.
That's
they like
right.
Brown eggs or white eggs?
Well, there's not much difference in the quality of brown eggs or white eggs. Here in New York, of course, is largely a white egg market. In other words, the white egg would bring more money here in New York than the brown egg. Whereas in Boston, it's just the opposite. They prefer to have the brown eggs up there rather than the whites. But there's no difference in quality.
Same way in Philadelphia. Philadelphia's a brown egg.
That's so.
And now about your income. I don't want to get personal here, but roughly, what does the egg auctioneer average in a year?
You mean as far as salary?
Yes.
Well,
Do you work on commissions?
No, we work on straight salary.
You do work on
straight salary. We work on straight salary, and of course, I don't really like to say what I'm being paid because my...
It's a baby.
Employer might be listening in, and he may be thinking that I'm not getting enough.
Well, I'm going to ask you a very personal question here, Mr. Zadra. You sell all these eggs, but do you eat them?
I'm very, very sorry to say that the only time I eat eggs is on a Sunday morning. And that's due to the fact that I've got to get up too early to get to work in time. And I have to commute. Naturally, I haven't got the time to eat the eggs. But I do have them every Sunday, and I do love them.
How many do you eat on a Sunday morning?
Oh, about four.
About four? Well, that's very good. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Zadra. And I hope we didn't go too far behind the scenes into your private life, but I think you did present a very clear picture.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Of the egg situation and the egg auctions. Now we come to Mr. Hiram H. Park, the president of the Park Burnett Galleries, the auctioneers of artistic and literary property. Mr. Park, how long have you been in the business?
42 years.
42 years. You've probably seen a great deal of changes. How did you happen to get into auctioneering of artistic properties?
Well, I first went into the auction business as a clerk. And shortly after, probably 6 or 8 months after going in as a clerk, I was called upon by my employer to relieve him on the stand. He was the auctioneer at that time, and his throat had some affection of his throat at the time, and he asked me to relieve him, and from then on I've been an auctioneer.
I see. The main personal...
I'll say he's a swell one.
Well, Mr. Day, I know you're a mutual admiration society here, Mr. Park, as you said yourself a little while ago, and I know you're going to help me with the interview here. You just stay right with us, will you? Because I'm going to miss a few questions, I'm sure.
The
main personal requisite in your work is, of course, knowledge of the art goods that you handle, isn't it?
That is true.
That's the first and foremost thing.
First and most important thing.
And what's next? What's the next requisite?
Well, getting the proper goods to sell and getting the buyers for those goods, knowing how to reach the buyers.
A knowledge of personal psychology, we might say.
That's one of the main essentials of the auction business, the art business especially, art and literary.
Speaking of your business, what famous and outstanding art object have you sold?
Well, I've sold probably some of the most famous sales of art objects that have been sold in this country. In fact, the most outstanding sale was the Great Gary sale back in 1928, which realized over $2,290,000.
What was in that sale? What articles?
Well, the highest price picture in that particular sale was the Gainsborough's masterpiece of the harvest wagon, which realized at that sale $360,000.
Hmm. What else was sold there of importance and note?
Also in the same sale, there was a small bust, a marble bust by the great sculptor Houdin.
How much did that bring?
That brought $245,000. That was a bust of his daughter Sabine.
I see. How about your sales of old masters, for instance? You've ever had any outstanding ones there that you can recall?
Yes, we had the great Stillman sale in 1927, in which 37 paintings at that time brought $716,000. And the main picture there and the highest price ever realized for a Rembrandt painting was at that particular sale. And it was the total for the sale was $716,000, of which this one picture brought $270,000.
A Rembrandt. What picture was that?
That was a painting by Rembrandt of his son Titus.
Mm-hmm.
And it realized, I say, $270,000 and sold to the great house of Devine Brothers, Lord Devine, who passed away recently.
I wonder whether you've ever encountered the case of a very small audience resulting in a poor sale or anything of that sort.
Yes, I've had very large audiences and very small ones.
Inclemencies of weather, I imagine, affect that.
I recall back in about 1920, on Washington's birthday in 1920, we had a blizzard. And we were selling at that time a collection of Washingtonian material. In other words, objects that were mostly owned by Washington or
his descendants.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the sale was being conducted for one of the Washington family, one of his descendants. And we had this very stormy and snowy day.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't expect to have much of an audience, and Mr. Washington, Lanier Washington, wanted the sale postponed. We told him we thought that we'd have a crowd that day, but there wasn't much of a crowd, but the sale turned out to be very successful.
How was that?
And there were two very good and very liberal bidders at that particular sale. One of them was George D. Smith, one of the great book collectors and book salesmen of his day, and the other was Mr. William Randolph Hearst, and the two of them made that sale for us.
I see.
And it proved to be very successful.
Well, what was the largest audience? Skipping over to the other side, the largest audience that you ever
saw? That
was
in the Gary sale, which I had the pleasure of conducting at the Hotel Plaza on April 28, 1928. And the ballroom at that time, the seating capacity of the ballroom at that time was 1,800. But there were more than 3,600 people in the ballroom had passed through the doors.
Now, imagine you could hardly get up in the stand.
It was the sale was scheduled for 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 9 o'clock before I could get to the rostrum.
And it was a big
success. Started the sale, and the sale was a big success. That evening sale run about $1,400,000.
Well, now, I know we're speaking in big terms, and we're speaking of people who buy. Big money terms, I mean, of course. People who buy art objects. Have you ever encountered cases of unlimited counterbidding on the same article?
Yes, I once had an instance in Philadelphia where I was selling a sale for one of the very wealthy families there in Philadelphia. And one of the most prominent citizens at that time was executor for this particular estate. And just on the eve of the sale, he was called to Brussels and had left me an unlimited bid on a pair of pictures. And the sale came off within a few days, and I was selling these particular pictures. and I noticed that they had run up to considerably more than we thought they were valued at. And the only two that seemed to be bidding at that time was myself as auctioneer and one of my assistants. I called to him and asked him I couldn't ask him his bid exactly, but I asked whether he had had some sort of an unlimited bid left with him, and he said that he had had, that he had. And I, knowing that I had this unlimited bid from the executor or his representative, I merely stopped the sale of those two pictures, withdrew them from the sale until I could get the two bidders together.
And settle it that way.
And it was settled in that way, and they were divided. One taking the female portrait and the other the male portrait.
I see. Well, thank you very much. You've given us a wonderful story there.
You split a family, didn't you?
Indeed.
Auctioneer of artistic properties, Mr. Parks. Now I'm going to turn around here to Mr. Joseph P. Day, the auctioneer of real estate, who's all set and ready to go. Mr. Day, you've been very quiet. But your fame as an auctioneer runs right along with our other guests this evening, and you're certainly one of the super salesmen of the day. You've never by any chance sold the Brooklyn Bridge, have you?
No, but I sold the 6th Avenue elevators.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Tell us about it. You sold the 6th Avenue elevated?
Yes.
Tell me all about that.
That's a short story. Sold it. After they bought it, they found out that there was cement in the pillars, and so they lost money on it. But that wasn't the fault of the auctioneer or anybody else. Nobody knew about it.
How does selling real estate differ from the methods of these other gentlemen?
Well, it's the principles, I think, are the same in all. It's sort of action. It's first attention, and then desire,
mm-hmm.
and then finally it leads up to getting
the actual sale.
Yes, getting the sale itself.
Well, now, what real estate have you auctioned at the highest price? What big package have you sold? What's your biggest package?
The Henry Astor Estate.
How much did that go for?
$6 million.
Oh, my goodness.
$6 million.
$6 million. How much?
The Commodore Gould Estate went for $6.5 million. And the James Gordon Bennett Estate, the owner of the late New York Herald before it was taken into the Herald Tribune.
Yes.
That was lots up in the Bronx. And that sold up in Washington Heights, and that sold for $1,700,000 in the afternoon, and the biggest buyer was this Dr. Paterno.
You've had many millions of dollars come across the auction block. How much real estate have you sold at auction, do you imagine, in the course of your work as an auctioneer?
About $1 billion worth.
About $1 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Beginning with a B.
Billion. Not million, billion.
Why is real estate often auctioned off instead of being sold off at a set price? I don't understand that.
Why, it's the reason of that is estates where there's heirs and children and scattered heirs, and it's sold then to the order, sold by the highest bidder.
To settle financially the estate.
And there's a law in many states that there's no buy bidding.
No.
In New York State, there's no buy bidding permitted.
What do you mean by buy bidding?
Why, there's nobody can go in and
bid it up?
Boost up the sale. No,
it must be
bona fide.
I suppose
that's the protection.
I suppose psychology plays a big part in your auctioneering, doesn't it?
It does.
Do you have any reminiscences on that subject of psychology?
Well, now we're talking about this arms restriction.
Yes.
Sal Bloom.
Yes.
I sold him a piece of property one afternoon for $340,000.
You really did? Tell us about that.
Well, he didn't. He thought his bid was only $335,000, and I said, Sal, you've got to take it. It's $340,000. That's what I took your bid at. And he came back 2 hours. He went out a little bit angry, and he came back 2 hours after, and he said, Joe, is that still open for me? I said, it certainly is. And I expect you to take it. Or at least I want to take it. I've just sold the contract for $40,000 profit. I gave him the property at his bid. At the bid I said.
What's your hobby, Mr. Day?
Well, one of my hobbies is buying Gertie's prayer rugs at auction from that young man Park over there, or the Park
Mr. Park, is he a good judge of values?
Well, I think his judgment's pretty good on those things.
I see. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank you, Mr. Day, and you, Mr. Park. And as they say at an auction sale, all done. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening
to... No, not all done. Sold.
Sold. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Americans at Work, the program about you and what you do for a living, presented each week by the CBS Department of Education. Previous Americans at Work scripts, complete with directional cues, have been printed in attractive pamphlet form. Single copies may be obtained for 10 cents each, or for $1, you may secure a set of 13 different scripts. Just send your order to Americans at Work, CBS, New York. Tonight's program was directed by Brewster Morgan. The Workers' Education Bureau of America collaborates on research for the entire series. Next Thursday evening, Americans at Work will be heard from 10:30 to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. John Reed King speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
10 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time. Here's a distinguished timepiece, the 21 jewel Bulova President in the charm and color of natural gold. Curved, streamlined, an exceptional value. WJSV, Washington.
Boy, your name King Palad, claims you're big and bad and next to God. You must be mad. Lord, I sent you away with your tribal. You're coming after falling, and you see, yesterday is different from today. But boof, 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 I know the call of tribal warriors, I will say. When I'm in zone, I will tell you. We say we stop your force and fighting, that we stroke you with the lightning. Stop pray for God and then we clap you with the thunder. You see? I'm going to tell you something.
We don't want no more at that.
Gotta take his words and make it be. Living in the soul, as I would say. Go away with your tribal. Watching at you way with the tribal. Singing him no worship, no idol. Telling him no worship, no idol. All we do is worship the true and living God. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha, Rastafari, yeah. And so me say go away with your tribal. Pray for sit down and lick it from a chalice. And we call the gritty, now we chase the gritty. Instead of sitting down and deal with tribal, we prefer sit down and chant from a chalice. And then we throw away the malice, I will kill you. And some lead away call a tribal war. Watch your man. Said if you are, we will push you in a barrow, barrow, barrow. Say if you wipe away your sorrow, you will live to see tomorrow. Go away with your tribal. Continue not to check the survival. Me say fi stop your force and fighting, Jah will choke you with him lightning. Stop the force and fighting, Jah will choke you with him lightning. Oh, your name King Balad, claim that you're big and bad.
No more,
you must be mad, you must be mad. You feel me say you wanna come and down and war. Then we gonna throw you all down in a. In our carriers, I will say, you lost. Then in our carriers, I will tell you. For I, Father, say, come and make me peace and love. Don't in the ghetto, peace and love. Don't in the ghetto. Some little way call a tribal, faith is survival. Lord, and we no worship, no idol. Some we say we check the survival. Until you in no worship, no hide out. So me really say, me say, think away with the tribal.
It's not sipping cup and licking a cup, 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 cup.
Yeah, come on, let me till you take a sip from the idol cup. Let me take a sip from the idol cup. Say that no bluff, me I bluff to take a sip. Say that no bluff, me I bluff to take a sip. Now come and take a sip of me hital cup. Won't you not teach you well hital? And then he come and then he be your well vital. As long as we get love and unity, he not
no more.
Talking about that, and we no watch that, and we believe that. When we say believe out the tribal, come and make me check the survival. Down in the ghetto, we leave out the tribal. When the tribe gonna burn like an iniquity. And we come and make me chase iniquity out the city. Till you say we chase iniquity out the city. Say Lord, I say we chase them crazy. So me say we chase them crazy. So me mercy madness. Right, Jay, not the judgment. But it's a lay preacher, never mind to looking at himself. I know himself, I know in every brother is a brother. So you feel love one another. Then you see you can't get no fuss and no quarrel.
Sterreplaten Extra.
Weird music isn't weird anymore. It's just music that exists.
Goedenavond en welkom bij Sterreplaten. Hier tegenover in hal vijf is, of was daarnet in ieder geval, een lezing bezig. Geen idee of daar nog een vervolg aan gebreid gaat worden. Maar mocht je tijdens de uitzending gewoon een beetje applaus op de achtergrond horen, weet dat het niet vanuit onze studio komt, maar wel van de ruimte hiernaast. Maar in ieder geval, vandaag in de uitzending hebben we Maarten te gast. Die gaat een nieuwe Gonzo komen voorstellen. Maar we gaan beginnen met een random Name Your Price track van op Bandcamp. Het is van de hand van de Schotse Richu Campbell. Dat is de doedelzakspeler. Voor deze track werkt ze samen met Dimcho Enchev. Ja, dat is eigenlijk ook haar Bulgaarse evenknie. Speelt eigenlijk ook doedelzak. Dus die twee tezamen. Dit is het begin van Sterreplaten. Richu Campbell en Dimcho Enchev. Goedenavond. Thank you. dubbele doedelzak om sterrenplaten mee te beginnen. Brichu Campbell en Dimcho Enchev. We hebben een Gentenaar als volgende. In het echtleven heet hij Benoît Monsieur, maar hij maakt muziek onder andere de naam Venedictus Tempelboom. Vorig jaar bracht hij een EP uit op Krut, Truist was dat. En binnen 3 weken brengt hij een release uit. Het Vuil Volkske gaat uitkomen op Kraak. Binnen 3 weken dus. Hoe klinkt het? Ja, volk op een 12-snarige gitaar. Kleurrijk en weinig miserie, tussen haakjes vissen. Venedictus Tempelboom. Thank you. Ja, nog een beetje akoestische gitaar. We gaan eigenlijk in diezelfde sfeer blijven. Maar eerst deze Venedictus Tempelboom met kleurrijk en weinig miserie van op het album Het Vuil Volkske. Komt binnen enkele weken uit. Dus zoals beloofd, nog meer akoestische gitaren. Deze keer vanuit Madrid. Gisco Rojo heet hij. Speelt onder andere op 6 en 12 snarige gitaar. Maar voor dit album, zijn nieuwste album, speelt hij ook onder andere op dulcimer, Tibetaanse klank, schalen, banjo, een orgel. Eigenlijk een hele hoop instrumenten. Van op die nieuwe Ballad of the 90 Days, Gisco Rojo. Ballad of the 90 Days van Gisco Rojo. En om ons kwartetje akoestische gitaar, of ja, eigenlijk gewoon gitaar af te sluiten, hebben we ook nog Matt Ball. Dat is de gitarist van Big Brave. Die gaat zijn eerste solo-album uitbrengen. Amplified Guitar heet het. Ja, niet echt creatief, maar het beschrijft wel perfect wat het is, hoe het klinkt. Hij gaat uitkomen op The Garot. Ja, sfeervolle textuur, echt heel hard focus op sfeervolle texturen, atmosferen met de elektrische gitaar. Komt volgende week uit. To Catch a Light met Ball. Ja, misschien hoor je op de achtergrond ook een band die hier in half vijf aan het spelen is. Die het beste van zichzelf aan het geven is. Maar je hoort hier bij ons To Catch Light van Matt Ball. Zo dadelijk Maarten met een nieuwe gonzo, maar eerst nog even Sanitation van No Knuckle. Sanitation van No Knuckle. Ja, applaus op de achtergrond trouwens ook. Want Maarten is erbij gekomen met de nieuwe gonzo. Goedenavond, Maarten.
Ja, goedenavond, Sam. Ik denk dat dat applaus was voor die mensen die hier hun dagboek op muziek aan het zetten waren.
Dus, ja, kom. Niet te bescheiden, hè, Maarten?
Nee.
We zijn hier allemaal fan van jou. De nieuwe gonzo. Er staat weer een... Er staan interviews in. Er staan stukken over muzikanten in. Verdorie, het spel zit nu echt wel helemaal op de wagen. Maar we gaan het eerst hebben over Emily Wells.
Ja, Emily Wells, Amerikaanse multi-instrumentaliste. Ze heeft pas een plaat uitgebracht, Regards to the End. En het is volgens Neil Stubbing die het stuk geschreven heeft. Die zegt, je mag het beschouwen als echt een van haar beste platen, want ze is eigenlijk al 20 jaar actief. En eigenlijk op die plaat reflecteert ze eigenlijk een beetje... Ze zegt eigenlijk, de pandemie die we gehad hebben, dat is eigenlijk een voorafspiegeling van alle problemen of alle dingen die we gaan te maken krijgen met klimaatverandering. Die pandemie was eigenlijk klein bier vergeleken met de klimaatverandering en de impact op ons leven die dat gaat hebben. Maar ze kijkt dan eigenlijk ook terug, want ze zegt, ja... Als je over impact op een samenleving het wilt hebben, dan kun je ook gaan kijken naar de AIDS-crisis uit de jaren 80 in de grote steden, vooral in de Verenigde Staten. En natuurlijk vooral toen, vooral binnen de queergemeenschap, waar dat ze zelf ook een deel van uitmaakt. Dus die gedachten, die ideeën, het activisme dat ze daar rond heeft, dat heeft ze eigenlijk proberen te verwerken in toch een wat die Regards to the End, wat eigenlijk wel een, op die manier een persoonlijke plaat is geworden. En zoals het zelf zegt, muziek maak je niet in een vacuüm. Dus vandaar die reflecties zitten allemaal in die muziek verwerkt eigenlijk.
Ja, en dan eigenlijk de cover van, of de cover, sorry. Van de gonzo. Ja. James Sue.
James Sue, dat is eigenlijk Mitchell van Dinter uit Den Bosch in Nederland. Dat is eigenlijk een gast die begonnen is eigenlijk als DJ in een lokaal café. En hij was daar eigenlijk gegrepen. Hij probeerde daar platen te draaien, ook van flyers.